Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So, a little alert popped up on my timeline yesterday, Seth. The three-year anniversary of the Chris Paul trade to the Rockets. Does that feel like more or less than 3 years since the Chris Paul trade to the Rockets?
Oh, to the Rockets. Gosh, for a second, I thought you meant the trade to Oklahoma City.
No.
I thought that this time warp had really done a number on me.
No. 3 years from him coming from L.A. to Houston.
It does. That seems about the appropriate amount of time.
Yeah.
In some respects, it seems like a long, long time ago because that felt like a different era almost. But I do think that was when I think I gained the most respect I had for Daryl Morey, because that was when almost the entire rest of the league had decided to just shut up shop until the Warriors disbanded. They said, well, why bother? What am I even going to do? Maybe we'll just tank and we'll go. Where Daryl Morey decided, no, I'm going to fight and we're going to try to beat this indomitable foe.
Well, and I think specific to the Rockets too, Seth, that the league had kind of given up, and people covering the league had kind of given up on the Rockets being able to make a significant move like that, because they were only a year removed from the fallout with James and Dwight, which neither party wound up looking good in. And the Rockets were, you know, they did not have a great cap situation. I think it looked like they were going to have to finagle to do some things. And I don't think a lot of people knew that Chris Paul was even available or entertaining the idea of going to Houston, because the season prior was when D'Antoni had sort of turned James Harden into the point guard of the team. He led the league in assists. And so just from purely a traditional roster construct standpoint, it wouldn't have made the most sense. And yet, if you remember, just a few weeks before the trade was made, Daryl Morey was almost like a cockiness about him, like having some moves up their sleeve, where he clearly knew that James and Chris had been talking, and my guess is that they kind of knew which way the wind was blowing on Chris Paul wanting to get out of L.A. and become a Houston Rocket. And so that, I think that was a big thing too, is people, they didn't see another move like a Chris Paul, a future Hall of Famer, coming here as a possibility. Even,
you know what, you know what tells you what a good move it was, that I think a lot of people barely even remember how skeptical people were that it was going to work out. Because, oh, you got two ball dominant go. What are you going to do? They both like to hold the ball that much. Well, for one, we'll have just one of them on the court at all times.
That's right.
They don't have to always be on the court together. And it almost seems foolish now, doesn't it, that people had a big question mark about all that? Daryl Morey's MO has always been simply, all right, we're going to get as many really good basketball players on the floor as possible, and then we'll sort it all out.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could debate whether or not at the end, when they traded Chris Paul, was it getting to that point where it maybe wasn't working out between the two of them. We know there was friction between Harden and Paul, but certainly for the first season, that was the greatest, by far the greatest regular season in Rockets history, in a team that maybe should have won the whole thing.
Right, it's really easy when the standard is, okay, if you didn't win a championship, then it was a bad move. All right, great. Then every move that's ever made is always a bad move.
Right.
If you want to be more realistic and say, all right, did that move get them closer to beating the Warriors and potentially winning a championship? It certainly did that season. I mean, in many other seasons in the NBA, that Rockets team would have been a championship team. It's just that the damn Warriors existed that year.
Well, and the remnants of the trade are, in a weird way, Seth, the trade still has legs, because Paul was what you used by and large to get Russell Westbrook here.
Yeah.
And the Rockets are still on the short list of contenders for an NBA championship. Their odds are the fourth longest on the board, the fourth shortest on the board, I should say, at 10-1. So they're still a team that needs some things to happen, but they're a team that's going to be, we think, a tough out in the postseason. But in reading back about the trade with Chris Paul, it got me thinking about that summer, and I'll I'll use a little bit of liberty in defining the summer as the end of April through the end of August, a four-month period from April 27th through August 31st, where, if you remember, in early 2017, we were in a decent spot as a sports city, certainly compared to 2013, where we had two of the two worst teams in their respective sports, and then the Rockets were very average. 2017, early 2017, okay, you know, the Texans had won the division, and they had gotten rid of Brock Osweiler, so, you know, hey, maybe with an actual quarterback, they can go 11-5 instead of 9-7. The Rockets were in the middle of a season where they had gotten their pep back in their step. Harden was putting up some MVP numbers. And then the Astros had not yet won the World Series, but they were going into the 2017 season as a team that there was a lot to be excited about, right? And even before they got Verlander, there was a lot to be excited about. They made each of those teams, that was a crazy, crazy four-month period because each of those teams, which were already fairly star-laden, each of those teams made big trades that completely ratcheted up the star power and the winning culture, we hope, long-term, of each of those three teams. The Texans trade up to get Deshaun Watson in the draft in late April. The Rockets make the trade of like eight players and draft capital for Chris Paul. And then the Astros make the 11th-hour trade for Justin Verlander. Those are three guys, Seth, and I'll count Deshaun in that group because Deshaun was as big a collegiate star as we've seen in the last 20 years. Watson, Paul, and Verlander were star-level guys to the extent like, wow, it's been a while since we've seen. We've got stars, but these are guys who are big, national, huge stars in their respective sports. All became Houston athletes within a four-month period.
Yeah, it was. It's been... I'll tell you what, Sean. It's been a roller coaster in terms of publicity for all of these teams at various moments. Like, you think about the relevance of the Astros, the ensuing scandal that just culminated last year, the Rockets and all of their unorthodox way of going about business, and then the Texans, from Deshaun Watson on until now, the soap opera that's gone on with Bill O'Brien and his various offensive coordinators or general managers or whatnot. I mean, that's stuff that's just written for television, is it not? And whether it's for good reasons or for bad, Houston has probably risen up above they're punching above their weight class, like in terms of our ability to command national attention. Sometimes I feel like for better or for worse, we get more than our share. And lately it feels like a little bit of it's been for worse.
Yeah. So, well, and look, just going back to the Rockets, Daryl Morey's China tweet. I mean, that was a story that transcended sports. So, boy, that's something Seth, you gave me my project for today. The top soap opera storylines over the last few years in Houston. Like, not forget about winning, soap opera storylines, because you're right. And you espoused it before anybody else that we were a quarterback away from entering a golden age of Houston sports. And we may still very well be. The Astros have done their part for sure. The Texans need to do some heavy lifting and the Rockets came close and we'll see what they can do. But where you may have been right about that is the golden age of just juicy storylines. I mean, I can't think of a better period of time to be living in any city when it comes to storylines over a 2 or 3 year period that have gone beyond just, hey, are you winning championships?
I mean, how many times, I think, has a Houston sports team created a story that has become like a crossover hit that people that aren't even sports fans know? Like, at any given time in sports, there's usually one or two topics that the non-sports fan can go to a cocktail party and be like, hey, so Tom Brady went to Tampa, huh? Like, it's a crossover hit. The casual, even non-sports fan knows it. I feel like the DeAndre Hopkins trade might have jumped up into that category because there was so much talk about it. I think that, let's see, probably just Bill O'Brien, the general manager, I think crossed over into the non-sports fan because people were so incredulous about either Laremy Tunsil or Jadeveon Clowney.
Tampering.
Oh, tampering. Casario. That's right. And that involved, man, how did we not bring up the tampering when it comes to the Patriots? How about that? That we couldn't. This is the thing. You don't try to hustle a hustler, right?
Right.
And the Texans tried to hustle a hustler.
Right.
That's the biggest. If you're going to tamper with a team, by all means, don't try to tamper with the New England Patriots. They're going to get you.
Right.
They're going to have surveillance everywhere. So, Yeah, I think that the Texans had a lot of crossover hits. I think the Rockets had crossover hits, especially with the Paul trade. I think that was, especially because that was in kind of a dead time in sports in the summer. And so that was their crossover hit. Astros, we don't even have to mention what their crossover hit has been over the last several months. So good for you, Houston Sports.
I would argue, too, I mentioned the China tweets earlier, Seth. I would argue a crossover hit for the Rockets was the fallout, maybe fallout's too strong a word, but just the public kerfuffle between Mike D'Antoni's camp and the and Tillman Fertitta, really.
Oh,
you know, when,
yeah.
Where they were having a hard time getting Mike, you know, working out Mike D'Antoni's contract, and Mike D'Antoni sort of a passive personality, letting his agent do all the talking, Tillman going to West Virginia to try to go circumvent the agent to work a deal out with D'Antoni. Tillman calling that impromptu press conference where he said all those things and got everybody so angry about the whole situation. Absolutely, that's a crossover hit.
That,
too.
I don't know. See, I don't think that's a crossover because I think that that doesn't even cross over into amongst sports fans. Like, I think if you get the if you ask the guys at NFL.com about that, they probably weren't even vaguely aware of any of that drama. So the crossover has to be people that aren't even sports fans know what to bring up at a cocktail party.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, so Daryl Morey, I mean, Daryl Morey's stuff became part of the actual news.
Yeah.
Anytime you enter the actual news.
Yeah.
Like, the Astros entered the actual news, right? Daryl Morey entered the actual news. I don't know if Bill O'Brien or any of the things that... Oh, no. The Texans entered the actual news with Bob McNair. Going back to the inmates comment and all that. So the Texans have been in the actual news a few times in the last few years.
Wow. Yeah, we've had some good soap opera storylines and quite a bit of winning. You know, maybe not to the extent, you know, maybe not to the extent of cities that have won multiple championships across most sports, but the teams have all been relevant to anywhere from relevant to championship contender over that 3 year period.
This is the problem though. Yeah, I think sometimes when people say, "Oh, woe is me, Houston sports," they're failing to recognize places like Cleveland,
Pre-Cavs
championship, Detroit especially, right? Yeah, which city is it? There are a few cities that have gone the longest without a championship of any sort, I believe. Let's see. Anyway, we're not one of those cities.
No.
But it's almost sometimes when you have a little taste of success, but you don't get ultimate success, it makes you that much hungrier for more.
Right.
So we're the disgruntled middle class is what we are.
Summer of 2017, man. That was the summer of star power imports is what that was. Watson, Paul, and Verlander in a 4 month period. That was wild times, man.
That Verlander was a crossover hit, just the signing of Verlander, because it came with Harvey as well. Anything involving Harvey in sports became a crossover hit.
Yeah, and Kate Upton. It came with Kate Upton as well.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So it's a crossover hit from that respect.
Yeah, from the modeling world. So there you go. Who is getting screwed over the worst with this new season of baseball? That's next. Ken Rosenthal did a notebook this weekend, essentially outlining some of the ins and outs of baseball coming back. And Seth, he basically turned the notebook column into like Festivus with an airing of the grievances, where he was kind of listing all the different entities that get a little bit screwed over with this short season, the schedule format that they're using. There were two that stood out to me because it hits home. You know, you got Carlos Correa, who's going to be eligible for his last year of arbitration this coming season, off season. You got George Springer, who's entering free agency. The free agents are the ones that have been discussed quite a bit as guys who are getting screwed, but free agents have been getting a little bit screwed with the way the market has worked for the last couple of years, with a few exceptions, Gerrit Cole being one of them. Rosenthal brings up arbitration-eligible players, especially guys entering arbitration for the first time who are getting the opportunity to make seven-figure salaries for the first time, that coming off of a season that's only a 60-game season, the thought is that there are going to be a ton of owners who arbitration is already a process where the owners are trying to degrade what it is you did. Rosenthal speculates it's going to be even worse this season because not only will they be picking holes in your performance, whatever your weak spots are, but they'll also be saying that whatever your strong suits are, you did it for 60 games. Like,
yeah,
wake me up when you do it for 162.
The arbitration committee is a tough one to figure out because even as all these owners have gone over to the analytical side of things, and that's one of the reasons that free agency has changed is because the owners have gotten way more analytic about things. Even as they do all that, when it comes to the arbitration committee, the arbitration loves old school stats. You know, they still care about relief saves.
Yeah.
Wins, pitcher wins. They think they care about all these things that by and large, even non-analytical people don't care about as much anymore because they realize, okay, there's things that tell a better picture.
Yeah.
And so these old school arbitration committees, how are they going to handle it's a 60-game season. None of that means anything to me. I don't know. I think they really have no choice though, do they? But to look at, okay, prior body of work, and then how did you play this year? Maybe this season's – maybe a lot of these guys that were hoping to have one last awesome season before arbitration or before this arbitration were – they're going to get screwed. But maybe the guys that had – you know, guys that are injured this year but had great years prior to this one, I imagine they'll benefit from not having this season.
Maybe. And I guess just to lay the groundwork for this, because there's probably plenty of people listening that don't follow that part of the game that closely – players are generally under team control for about 6 years. And for most players, depending on how their service time is manipulated from the minor leagues to the majors, it's usually 3 years at a roughly minimum salary, and then 3 years of escalating arbitration amounts that are either agreed to between the player and the team or have to go to an arbiter for the arbiter to pick one side or the other in those things. I think what you may see, Seth, is more cases actually making it to arbitration as opposed to teams agreeing beforehand that – okay, you know, usually what happens, you know, is Carlos Correa is heading into his first year of arbitration. He thinks he should be $4 million. The Astros think he should be $3.1 million. So a lot of times they just agree to split the difference, or they come to some sort of agreement. Or in the case of Alex Bregman, they agree to a blockbuster extension that buys out the arbitration years and has the Astros on what will ultimately be in years 4, 5, and 6, a very team-friendly deal where Bregman gets a lot of his arbitration money bought out, but he gets big sums up front. So that's how it works. So that's where arbitration becomes a thing for usually years 4, 5, and 6 when a player is in Major League Baseball. I think that's what we'll see is more cases have to get decided by an arbiter because teams and players just aren't going to be able to agree because this 60-game season is just too big a statistical anomaly.
So then the question becomes, okay, how are fans going to get screwed by this shortened season?
Right.
And I think the biggest one is, okay, are the Astros more or less or the same affected when it comes to re-signing George Springer by this shortened season?
I think the overall pandemic, you know, which the 60-game season is part of, because I think Springer's going to have a good season. I think it improves their chances of keeping. It sounds weird because Jim Crane is among the owners who's maybe most disproportionately affected by not having fans in the stands because their local TV contract is so bad. But I do feel like it's going to suppress competition for some of these guys like Springer, who I don't think is viewed quite at the Mookie Betts level around the league. Betts is an MVP. Yeah. Springer is like a perennial all-star. He's a cut below. And I believe Jim Crane when he says we're really motivated to keep George Springer. And he said that even as recently as while this has been going on. He didn't say Springer by name, but he did say in his press conference last week that they're still going to be aggressive when it comes to signing and re-signing guys, and there's no bigger priority than George Springer. Seth, I think in a weird way, counterintuitively, that this whole thing improves the chances of the Astros retaining George Springer. Maybe not on a 5-year deal, but maybe for another 1 or 2 years and he goes back in and tries free agency again a year from now, something like that.
Well, and I think, too, that, look, if you had to choose between keeping Correa and Springer, even though they're 1 year apart in free agency, that's a decision you kind of make together, right? If you re-sign Springer, you're less likely to keep Correa.
True.
I think Springer is going to be cheaper because he's older, you know, and he's not the player at his peak that Correa is. He's going to be a cheaper guy to retain, who also goes a whole lot longer, I think, in terms of reaching out to the fans and being sure that we give you a big old hug after all the cheating scandal. Oh, Sean, I didn't tell you. This weekend, I stayed at a hotel in Arkansas. And the woman that worked there, I had to work with a woman to set up some internet service.
Yeah.
She's an Astros fan.
Oh, wow.
But not like a huge sports radio listener or anything. But she grew up in Oklahoma, and she just hated all the It wasn't even the Rangers at that point. Wait, who else would be up? Would Cardinals fans up in like northern Oklahoma?
Yeah, I could see that. Missouri kind of bumps up against that part. Yes.
She was sick of that, and then she lived in Arlington, and she got sick of the Rangers, so she just gravitated towards the Astros, and she's loved these Astros. But she was distraught because she feels like she's not sure what to do about the Astros. So I talked to her about 20 minutes about all the reasons why she should forgive the guys that did cheat. Mm-hmm. She should remember that Altuve didn't look like he cheated at all. Mm-hmm. And that also, just aside from the human element of forgive and move on, a lot of these new guys didn't have anything to do with it. And then I reminded her, in summation, I basically gave her a 3-minute speech about George Springer and how he is basically all that is good in human beings.
Those are all great points.
Including the faults of sometimes perhaps pushing the limit a little too far.
So she's having a moral dilemma with rooting for the Astros because of the sign-stealing scandal? Is that what you're saying?
That's what she said,
genuine. Okay, well, you know what, Seth? Your response was more cordial than mine would have been. I would have said, well, we don't need you then. If you can't overcome your little moral dilemma over sign-stealing that every good team in the league is already doing, we don't need you. And in fact, I'm not staying at your hotel anymore. You can deinstall whatever internet it is you just set up for me. I'm insulted that you even set it up for me.
Sean, I feel like you've watched too many mob movies. I feel like you live in this alternate world where you just the morality is a lack of morality.
Yeah.
That no, you in abiding by the rules of our culture is you need to embrace not following the rules.
Yeah. I would have been like, listen, you broad, have you heard of Omerta? It's the you ride or die.
I said, listen, the woman's name is Brandy with a Y, not like my wife with an I. So I said, listen, Brandy, you're gonna feel this little sting the next time you're cheering for the Astros. That's pride.
That's
effing
right
with you.
Yeah, Pulp Fiction,
pride.
Baby. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. That's what Bruce Willis did in Pulp Fiction. Yeah. The other thing that Rosenthal outlined, Seth, in terms of guys or teams. One team over another maybe getting screwed is, as we've mentioned, part of the crossover with the National League that each of these teams are going to have is they are going to play a disproportionate number of games against their quote-unquote annual rival that they play every year. Now, the Astros, if you're like, well, who's the Astros' annual rival? It's a great question because they don't really have one in the National League. It's easy with some of these teams, you know, the Royals and the Cardinals. Those are natural rivals. White Sox and Cubs, Angels and Dodgers, A's and Giants, Yankees and Mets. Those are natural geographical rivals that are very, very easy to have games with. And you could see why baseball has plugged in some of those because it makes for less air travel for some of those teams. You can take a bus or whatever. But the Astros do have a rival team that they play every year in the National League, and it's one of two teams. In odd-numbered years, it's the Rockies. I don't know if you knew this, Seth.
Oh, yeah, I've hated them for a long time.
And in even-numbered years, it's the Arizona Diamondbacks. So the Astros, that's their heated National League rival this year Diamondbacks.
Yeah. Quite passionate in my hatred for the Arizona Diamondbacks, who reside in Phoenix? Yeah. It's I can't stop hating on them. Sometimes I have a hard time sleeping at night and Brandy says, "Seth, what's going on? Are you thinking about the Astros and how they've been wronged in this cheating scandal?" No, I'm thinking about the Diamondbacks, damn it. And you know that. You know not to ask me that.
You're like, and she's like, "Well, which player in particular are you thinking about?" And you're like, "The tall one? The second baseman?"
The catcher? I hate the Diamondbacks so much, Sean, that I've got a list of Diamondbacks jokes that I tell at parties.
Do you really?
Do you want to hear this? Ben, get the rim shot
ready. Ben, get
ready.
Yeah, yeah.
These are my tried and true D-back jokes that I tell at parties. I don't even care if there's a Diamondbacks fan there. I'll whip out these jokes.
Right.
Let's see. Hey, Sean. What's the difference between a bucket of poop and a Diamondbacks fan?
I don't know, Seth. What is the difference between a bucket of poop and a Diamondbacks fan?
The bucket. Hey, Sean.
Yeah.
Sean, just sitting here talking about my hated rival, the Diamondbacks.
Right.
What's the difference between a dead dog in the road and a dead Diamondbacks fan in the road?
What's the difference, I don't know, between a dead dog in the road and a dead Diamondbacks fan in the road, Seth?
There are skid marks in front of the dog. Hey, Sean, what do Diamondbacks fans use for birth control?
Hey, Seth, I don't know. What do Diamondback fans use as birth control?
That's simple. They're personalities. One last one.
Yeah.
Why did the Diamondbacks fan cross the road? I was thinking when I accelerated. That last one was the only good one. These are all, I feel like we've done this once before. I think that there's a bunch of these jokes that get repurposed and they just, somebody finds a bunch of hacky jokes and reinserts Diamondbacks fan.
For lawyers. Yeah, those are actually lawyer jokes, but we installed the Arizona Diamondbacks. But the
Worth? Is the World's Most Tasteless Jokes. Remember those books?
Oh,
I feel like whoever authored that has been canceled by now, right?
Gotta be.
Yeah, those used to be some pretty tasteless jokes.
The reason why some of the teams are angry about these rivalry series is because, for example, in the National League Central, it's awesome for the Cardinals, Seth, who get six games with the Kansas City Royals, who suck. The other teams in that division, specifically the Cubs, Brewers, and Reds, all cross over with the White Sox, Twins, and Indians, who are all, I mean, the Cardinals are getting six games where they theoretically should go like 5-1, and the Cubs, Brewers, and Reds are all getting games where they'll be, they're getting teams where they'll be, you know, they'll, if they go 3-3, then they're just doing their job at that point.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, there's some things that the coronavirus created that you can't complain too much or worry too much about, but you're right, when it comes to these things, which it always feels kind of frivolous, right? The interleague play, that somehow that can affect your standings to such a large degree just based on who your rival team is. That seems that they didn't have to do this part.
No.
It feels gimmicky for the sake of gimmickry.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing I hate. It's that Madison Bumgarner. Oh, boy, ever since he became a Diamondback.
He did. Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah. So did you you looked it up. Yeah.
I did.
All right. If you want to weigh in, 713-572-4610, that is our text page. We will touch on Cam Newton again. Cam Newton's Hall of Fame chances seem to have been completely extinguished. Is this the one chance to rekindle those, him signing with the Patriots? That's next. Seth, I think it's safe to say with Cam Newton that he's not one of these guys, good player, MVP at one point. He's not a player, though, who can slap his nine seasons in the NFL on the table and say, if this is it, then reserve a spot for me in Canton. Not even close. He made it to one Super Bowl and lost. He's a three-time Pro Bowler. He was an MVP in 2015. And so he's still got work to do if he wants to get into that conversation. But we've seen quarterbacks before who peaked at MVP levels, bottomed out, and then, and I say quarterbacks like there's been a ton of them, but I think of Kurt Warner when we have conversations like this, who had a second act somewhere along the way, and that was enough to push their Hall of Fame candidacy over the edge. I think ultimately Cam needs to win a Super Bowl somewhere to be in that conversation. But I would say that this is probably as good an opportunity as he could land on if that part of his legacy is important. That having come off of two seasons where he was just football tragically banged up, that this is about as good an opportunity as he can get some of that mojo. But I still think the chances of him being a Hall of Famer, it's, you know, the possession arrow is pointed against him right now. But this is, if he's healthy, a decent opportunity to get back into, to get his career back on that sort of trajectory, I think.
Well, think about in Cam Newton's mind about everything you just said. In Cam Newton's mind, I'm guessing he's probably thinking best case scenario is he has a good season this year and then parlays that into a several years contract with the New England Patriots and maybe plays, look, 5, 6, 7, 8 more years. I think we as fans have looked at Cam Newton and watched the punishment he takes and see his injuries over the last couple of years. And we kind of think, well, that's probably going to be it for him, right? Maybe a couple more years as he kind of tries to play out the string. Unless he lands in the perfect circumstance where they use his body as a threat, but that Josh McDaniels and Bill Belichick come up with other ways for him to continue to be even more efficient as a passer and play opposite of a really good defense. And Cam might be thinking, yeah, I've got a shot at winning a Super Bowl and playing a few more seasons. And then if anything, Sean, you know what it becomes? This becomes a bigger indictment on Ron Rivera than anything else. If Cam goes and has like four winning seasons in a row with the Patriots, then all of a sudden Ron Rivera looks like the guy that was holding Cam back in Carolina.
Right. So I'm looking at Cam Newton. I'm looking at his Pro Football Reference page right now, and they do a thing, Seth, where they've got similarity scores for positions where you can sort of quantify things. Pro Football Reference has that approximate value, which is kind of a nebulous. It's a little like win shares, kind of. And then they've got the regular stats for quarterbacks. The names of quarterbacks that Cam is most similar to through certain years of his career, they start measuring it after 3 years. And the names that he's brushing up against are all in Hall of Fame conversations or already actually in the Hall of Fame. You know, for years 7, 8, and 9 of his career, these are the names he's bumping up against. Russell Wilson, Peyton Manning, Dan Marino, Brett Favre, Drew Brees, Matt Ryan, probably borderline. For his career, the quarterbacks that Cam Newton is statistically most similar to, and I think this illustrates the fine line that he's walking in terms of, you know, where he is statistically. The most similar, Russell Wilson, who I think is a future Hall of Famer. The next one, Trent Green, who is a stat compiler who played for some teams that made the playoffs in Kansas City. The next one, Roger Staubach, Hall of Famer. The next one, Kurt Warner, who I just brought his name up 5 minutes ago. Tony Romo, the next after that, Randall Cunningham. So it's all these guys, Seth, where...
Right on the edge.
Right where they all played at a level, at a skill level that was Hall of Fame, but I think what separated them, yes or no, were the team accomplishments that they were on.
And this adds so much more juice to the Belichick versus Brady legacy discussions.
Yeah.
You know, who can help or hurt their legacies the most over these next couple of years? Because let's remember, Belichick does still have a losing NFL record when Tom Brady isn't his coach. So he hasn't genuinely proven that he can do it without Tom Brady. Excuse me. But without Tom Brady as his quarterback. Tom Brady hasn't obviously done anything without Bill Belichick. But now, yes, what if Belichick takes Cam Newton and turns him into as successful a quarterback as Tom Brady? That's score one for Belichick.
Yeah, well, and I think in some ways, Seth, maybe it appeals to Belichick even more that Brady and Newton are stylistically so dissimilar. You know what I mean? Like, it'd be one thing if he brought in a veteran quarterback who was accomplished in some way. Like, if they brought in Philip Rivers, who, you know, stylistically is obviously much closer to Brady than Cam Newton is, you're going to have to retool the offense in a much more massive way to accommodate Cam Newton than you would have with Philip Rivers, where you can execute that short passing game and the quick decision making and the reading of the defense, both on film and in the huddle, or, you know, as you're breaking the huddle, or in tempo and things like that. That's going to have been much more similar and feel like, well, they just, you know, plugged in somebody who's of that same ilk. I think the fact that you need to probably do a retool of everything will separate Belichick even more from his, you know, jointship with Brady.
Yeah.
You know?
And then, by the same token, Bruce Arians has to change his scheme somewhat for Tom Brady, too.
Yeah.
Just the Bruce Arians' lust for the deep ball, which I think has been overstated a little bit. It's not like he doesn't have any short passes at all or options. And likewise, it's not like Tom Brady can't throw it deep. But there is a scheme versus ideal player mismatch there that they'll both have to adjust to. And then, boy, all these guys. Then we got Jameis Winston if he gets to play in New Orleans. This is turning into an interesting storyline year for quarterbacks.
It is. I'm thinking the Brady thing through a little bit more, and it sounds silly to say, well, Brady, you know, in terms of leaving the Patriots, he's taking actually an easier route as opposed to Belichick, who's having to take Cam Newton, hope that he's healthy, and retool the offense in a season with a pandemic, where installation of a new offense is an issue that you and I haven't even really touched on much yet today. Brady, on the other hand, is going somewhere where, in theory, even during an offseason like this, look, the pandemic ain't scaring Brady from installing anything right now. We've got the video to prove that. And he's going to an offense where he's got two of the top 8 or 9 wide receivers in football, and he's bringing Gronk with him, too. It sounds weird to say this because it's still Tampa Bay, who hasn't won a playoff game since the Super Bowl in 2003. But it does feel like the degree of difficulty, at least for Brady doing his job and functioning as the steward of the offense, should be much easier in Tampa Bay than it was his last year in New England, just based on the weapons alone.
The only thing I wonder about in Tampa is the lesson that nobody ever seems to learn in the NBA is, hey, just because you put a bunch of names together doesn't mean you've actually improved a team's chances. Think back to the Lakers with Steve Nash or the Brooklyn Nets when they hoisted all those players from the Celtics. It's just because, I mean, Rob Gronkowski retired for a reason. Right. It wasn't just because he was sick of Bill Belichick being grumpy.
Yeah. Yeah, Gronk was so banged up at the end. I'm with you. I'm skeptical on Gronk. Evans and Godwin are the two guys that pop into my head where it's like, man, Brady is going to feel like last year was a year, Seth, where, you know, guys are in the on deck circle and they're swinging a bat with a big, huge weight donut on it.
Yeah.
And then they step in the batter's box and the bat feels like it weighs like a toothpick. This will be the toothpick year for Brady. Last year was the bat with the donut year in terms of the weapons on the outside.
Yeah, he'll have the things he wants to. Like last year, you saw the sideline mic camera during the Texans game. He's asking guys to be faster. And, you know, I think he genuinely meant it wasn't like the urgency or the pace or anything. He needed them to run faster.
Run faster.
And like they couldn't.
That's
like
funny.
It felt like Tom Brady last year. It was like him being in one of those nightmares where when you try to punch somebody, like your punch doesn't have any weight to it.
Yeah.
Have you ever had this nightmare? Like where I've had to defend myself and you go to punch somebody and it feels like your arm just goes limp as soon as it hits the person. There's absolutely nothing to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or if you shoot a gun to defend yourself and the bullet slowly rolls through the barrel and drops out the muzzle. Like that's how Brady looked last year.
You have some violent dreams, man.
No, they're not violent though. It's like the opposite of violence. There's attempted violence, and then but it's all for naught.
Dies down.
I have ineffectual dreams.
It dies down out of fatigue and improper weaponry.
And I feel like you're going to try to use this as some segue into a Blue Chew commercial. Fine. I'm fine on that front. I'm good.
No, Blue
Chew. My little monster is also a raging beast.
A little fella, and it's a raging beast. Yeah. So Adam Silver's quotes about the pandemic and the risk involved in it that these were interesting because Silver, I think, has been pretty conservative when it comes to this stuff. But I think you reach a point where you're trying to make sure that your owners get their hundreds of millions of dollars and you start to accept reality with all this.
I do want to point out that I think that the NBA has gotten all this credit for being conservative and careful and thorough.
Yeah.
And yet people are saying, Whoa, the poor NBA, now they're in Florida where it's a hotbed of activity. Yeah, that's the reason they're in Florida, because Florida was going to reopen faster and sooner than anybody else. Remember, DeSantis was like, hey, we're open for business.
Right.
Come on in. So look, Silver gets a little bit too much credit, I think, for being conservative on this. Like, they did decide to go to Florida simply because they were the ones that were open.
True. And they had a bunch of basketball courts down there at the Wide World of Sports. But you're right. There probably could have been other places they went.
Yeah, there's no other place in America where you can have a bunch of basketball courts with no fans in attendance.
That's what I'm told, Seth. I'm sorry. You can't. So Adam Silver told reporters, this is via Howard Beck of Bleacher Report, we are left with no choice but to learn to live with this virus. No options are risk-free right now.
Mm-hmm.
So how big a risk do we think the NBA players are taking here?
I think they, compared to like most other employees in the country, are still taking much less of a risk.
Yeah.
Because how many workplaces are genuinely trying? Well, they're trying to actually, a lot of workplaces are more effective at shielding coworkers from each other because they're not playing basketball against each other. So we know what the risk levels are for people that don't have underlying conditions. The risk levels are way, way less than for anybody with an underlying condition. And almost by definition, especially NBA players more so than any other sport, would seemingly probably have the fewest number of underlying conditions just because there are so few obese NBA. Even the guys that you think of as fat are nearly not what we think of as obese in real life. So I think that these guys are pretty safe.
Yeah.
I think, Sean, you have a lower tolerance for risk than actual most NBA players.
That I have a lower tolerance for, so I am more.
Because we were having some conversation about players in the offseason riding ATVs, and you thought that might be prohibited by their contract.
Yeah, it was when Ed Oliver had an ATV on the back of his his truck when he got pinched for DUI a few weeks ago.
Right.
Yeah, and
you seem more concerned about the ATV than the DUI.
Well, from the standpoint of he may have been drinking while he was. Is it safe to assume he was probably drinking and driving that ATV too? Or did he just park the ATV and then have a few beers and get in his truck? So, but ATVs do scare me. Seth, I think you're right. Like some of those things, like I think people who ride motorcycles are insane. Like I think
just it's people in general.
Just people in general. Yeah. Like I think when I see people, I'm like, what is the upside to riding the motorcycle? Like you hit one little divot on the, but you hit one little divot on the concrete and you could go flying.
I know. But that's the part where you compartmentalize. Usually all you're thinking about is just how cool it feels and how fun and free and just awesome it is to have the wind in your face.
So were you an avid motorcycle rider one time?
When I was a kid, I did. I mean, we rode dirt bikes a lot. I've never owned like a Harley or a road bike or anything.
Okay.
And I've got a cousin that has built his own motorcycles forever, and he has like Ducatis and stuff. And he was psychotic when he was a teenager.
Yeah.
And we lived out in the country. Rashawn, the cops weren't catching you if they had to try to catch you on a Ducati. If you're an insane person like my cousin was, so I was never, maybe because my cousin was so insane, I was never into it because I realized like, well, I don't need to be riding down 140 miles per hour down a blind turn in the woods.
What's a Ducati? Is that like the Lamborghini of motorcycles?
Like a crotch rocket type.
Yeah, you know, just crotch sort of rocket. Yeah. That's a setup for a Blue Chew commercial as well.
Okay, let me ask you this. Who's
turn
the baseball?
Your crotch rocket into a raging beast. Yeah.
There you go. Where do you stand on who is the baseball player that hurt himself cattle ranching a couple years ago? He stepped in a hole on his property. For the life of me, I can't remember who it was.
I don't know.
Where do you stand on just going out and cattle ranching?
What's define cattle ranching? Do I have to like rope some doggies and wrestle?
Yeah,
spear
yeah,
and
like you're doing.
Like
yeah, you're out. Yeah, you're out driving a herd or something.
Yeah, no, I can't do that. Like I watched the movie City Slickers, and I get stressed out when all the farmhands that went with them. You know, when Curly. Yeah. Spoiler alert: when Curly dies. And then the other two ranch hands who were with them get drunk and they leave. And now all of a sudden Billy Crystal and Daniel Stern and Bruno Kirby have to bring in the herd. That's really stressful to me.
I don't think Carlos Lee never got hurt on his ranch, did he?
No, I'm guessing he outsourced a lot of that work.
He was probably, he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
I'm with you. I guess the horse riding, except a lot of guys go horseback riding in the off season. If they were like doing equestrian events or something and trying to jump over fences and stuff, I'd be worried about it. But just some casual horse ride. Tony Brackens went to UT, defensive end. He and his family, they do, I think they do like the team penning. So that's where you're riding around as a group on horses. And Tony, I think he did that when he was playing.
Okay.
But Tony was kind of would do whatever the hell he wanted.
Former teammate of yours. Yeah. What other activities? Go ahead. Is this a section? Yeah. This is a segment where we figure out how big a wuss I am?
Yeah, let's see. Yes or no? What's your appetite for these activities in the off season amongst your athletes?
Okay.
Would you be okay with the Astros cliff diving?
No, and you know why? Because I feel like with cliff diving, there's a chance of a jutting rock somewhere.
Okay, good point there. Or slipping off the rock.
You saw Johnny Manziel cliff diving.
Yeah.
And granted, he might have been on something, but he was like one little foot slippage away from killing himself.
Yeah, I think that was. I think it was staged.
Act. Okay.
So, okay, then how about like high diving from like a high dive at a Olympic pool?
I am deathly afraid of slipping on the ladder, climbing up. That's
you're
my biggest
you're
fear.
You're afraid you're going to like pull a Greg Louganis either. Oh, you're afraid of the ladder.
I'm afraid of the climbing the ladder because you're usually wet when you're going up the ladder, and I've always been afraid of slippage going up the ladder. The actual getting out on the diving board is the part I'm least afraid of because I'll never do anything where I'm in danger of hitting my head on the board because I try to jump outwards.
Right, but we're asking, are you okay with the Astros?
Oh, my athletes? I would prefer they stay off the high dive. There's very little to be gained from jumping off the high dive.
What about just like doing a backflip on a normal sized diving board?
That's fine.
You're fine with that.
I'm okay with
like,
that.
Yeah, having like a pink belly is the worst that can come of that usually.
Yeah. I'm okay with
Let's say playing in a charity basketball game.
No.
A lot of guys do that, though.
Yeah, Seth, anything that tears an ACL.
But what if they're not playing defense? Like, what if it's a pretty chill environment and everybody's just kind of going along and going back and forth up and down the court?
I got it. It depends on who the player is. You know, the higher profile the player, the less I'm enthused about it.
A lot of guys do that to stay in shape in the offseason, so I don't worry about that at all. Yeah. And most guys are pretty cool about it. Like, they're not trying to win NBA 2K out on the court.
You know, Lance Berkman tore his ACL playing flag football in the offseason.
I thought it was softball.
No, I think it was flag football.
Was it? It was a church league something. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't play flag football.
Huh. No, you may be confusing that with Jose Lima, who used to play in rec league softball. He used to play on Lance Zierlein's rec league softball team wearing his Astros batting practice jersey to the game. Jose Lima
awesome.
Did. Yeah.
I played over at the Houston Sportsplex. My wife played in a co-ed league over there. And somebody was telling me once about how every now and then Steve McNair would come out because he had some friends that played for one of the teams. And he and you're right, it was flag football, Sean. I apologize for Lance Berkman. That the first time he showed up, McNair was like standing, you know, 20 feet past the dirt at shortstop, and people were wondering, why is he doing that? And a ball came to him, and he rifled the dude out at first from way back there, and everybody realized, like, oh, that's why he's doing that.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to take any chances of taking a softball to the face, and he could play pretty much anywhere. He could play 20 feet behind first base and make a play at short and throw
exactly,
somebody out at first.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. All right, what other activities could athletes take part in the offseason?
Zip lining? What about that?
Zip lining? I'm okay with zip lining.
I don't like extreme zip lining where you're 30 feet up in the air or anything. Yeah. And it's not because the athlete would do anything wrong, but if it's that thing, if that thing snaps, you're done for.
Yeah, yeah.
Bungee jumping?
Maybe I'm projecting here. I'd just be too afraid they'd have a heart attack while they're bungee jumping. That's scary, dude.
I always wondered. I wonder if people get like whiplash or something, though, too. Because it seems like a pretty violent change of direction at the end, doesn't it?
You're tied by your ankles, and I think if you were getting jerked, like I think whiplash comes when you get jerked sort of perpendicular. You know what I mean? Like theoretically, yeah. You're bungee jumping. That, I would imagine, might separate your vertebrae a little bit.
But you're going straight down, but then at some point you go slower, slower, slower,
and then, back
and then
up.
You get rocketed back
yeah,
up.
Maybe
but
so.
Maybe that's slow,
maybe
too.
So.
I guess you're right.
Yeah, maybe so.
Paintball?
Paintball, I would be, you know, paintball I'm okay with him doing. As someone who has never paintballed before, the thing I'm most worried about is getting shot in the junk.
Oh,
playing
yeah.
Paintball. That seems like it might hurt.
That could affect our athletes, right? It's a precipitous decline in testosterone right before the season.
Yeah.
We don't need that at all.
We do not, yeah. So those are all things that are more risky, I think, than going into the bubble for, not all of them, but, you know, those are risky activities comparable with the coronavirus. Seth, we are about out of time. I wonder which quarterback's going to sign with a team tomorrow to give us all this stuff to talk about.
Who's still out there?
Colin Kaepernick.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Has been for some time, hasn't
he?
He
has been. 3 years
if Kaepernick
now.
Signs, boy, I hope Kaepernick signs somewhere at 5:58 a.m. tomorrow.
Whew. Beautiful.
Let's just go ahead and clear the deck with our programming.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Yeah, no kidding. So we're done. Seth, I will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. I enjoyed it, as always.
Antibody and N95 masks to you.
Antibody and N95 masks to you as well, even with some T-cells sprinkled in for good measure. And to all of you, In the Loop, John Lopez, Landry Locker, Figgy Fig, they're up next. See you tomorrow at 6 a.m. Have a great day. Stay safe, everybody.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.